Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. We have with us Richard Brookhiser, Rick, who is senior editor at the National Review. He was telling me earlier that he began at National Review when he was 15 years old. It's a great story. He is the author of many books, most notably the biographies of figures from the years of the founding. In fact, he's probably our leading biographer in the public world of figures such as George Washington. One book is Founding Father, Rediscovering George Washington, Founder's Son, A Life of Abraham Lincoln. He has a biography of Alexander Hamilton as well.
Hamilton before he was cool.
Before Hamilton. Before Broadway Hamilton.
That's right.
Yes. Yeah. Very good. Also, I noticed you have a biography of the Adams family. Now, was that called America's First Dynasty, the Adamses, 1735 to 1918? Was that before that Adams series?
That was a spinoff of
David Giamatti, Paul Giamatti,
right?
John Adams.
That was before that, but that was a spinoff of David McCullough's book, which came out just before my Adams family book. And
okay.
In fact, they delayed the publication of mine to prevent it from being completely swamped by the Queen Mary. It didn't
okay.
work.
Okay. But you were working on it before McCullough's book came out.
Before his book came out.
And
yes.
Adams was kind of, you know, an overlooked founder. He's in Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind, but beyond that, any right.
Joe
Adams?
Ellis had done a book about him,
Patriot
Sage,
okay.
in
okay.
the mid-90s.
Okay.
And then David's book is just wonderful. I mean,
right.
he just fell in love with him and made him alive.
Right. Well, you also have a study of Governor Morris, another unrecognized founder.
My favorite. Well, I wanted to do him. I had done Washington.
You call him the architect of the Constitution, right?
Well, he was. He's the draftsman. He is the man on the final committee of style, the five-man group that's supposed to produce the final draft. And he's the one that they gave the assignment to. He also, I think, surprised everyone at the Constitutional Convention by what a good delegate he was. He spoke more times than anyone else, even though he missed a whole month.
Hmm.
So he spoke even more than James Wilson, even more than James Madison. He was smart, he was sharp, he could be funny. You know, the minutes of the Constitutional Convention are not a laugh riot, really, but mm-hmm. where there is a joke, it's told by this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
I wrote about Washington, wrote about Hamilton. He knew both of them, friendly, well, admiring of Washington, friendly with Hamilton. So here's this man I knew nothing about who keeps appearing, and he's always saying something smart or funny, usually both.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, this is an interesting guy. And so I wanted him to be the third bio, and my publisher said, no, you can do John Adams or Andrew Jackson. So I said, I'll give you the Adams family. And then they let me have him for the fourth book.
Mm-hmm.
And just fell in love with him. He was the one who was the best house guest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had his problems.
Morris was New York City? Or New York?
Yes, he was a New Yorker,
yeah.
Although he attends the Constitutional Convention as a Pennsylvanian because he'd been living there for 9 years and practicing law. So that's why they tapped him. But no, he's a New Yorker, and he has certain New Yorkers qualities. I mean, he's an aristocrat. He looks down his nose at people who aren't. His love life was very complicated. Lots of unhappy wives
mm-hmm.
of other men. He had a disability. He lost a leg in a carriage accident.
Hmm.
He caught his foot in a carriage wheel, and his doctor was out of town, so other physicians came and said, we're going to have to cut this off. And he said, okay, fine. And then when his doctor came back and heard what had happened, said, you know, I really don't think they had to do that. Huh. But he continued to dance, and he continued to explore upstate New York and do all sorts of physical things and, you know, made his peg leg part of his look.
Well, that's one of our founders.
That's right.
That makes him deserving.
That's right.
In that, I think in that book, in the little preface, there's a little statement. Since 1996, Richard Brookhiser has devoted himself to recovering the founding for modern Americans. So this was a mission you going back 20, 25 years.
Yeah, it became something. I realized, I'm doing this, and it's almost like I'm building something. I mean, you know, maybe not a wall, but something. And it's like, and it's block by block and life by life. And then, of course, they all knew each other. So they all reappear. People ask me, why haven't you done Jefferson? And one answer is, well, I keep doing him every book.
There's a lot of Jefferson in the latest one.
Especially the latest one. He always appears. The other reason not to do him head on is that he's so elusive. You know, I think Jefferson's head is like a house with a lot of rooms and they don't all have doors.
Complicated character.
They don't all have connecting doors. Yeah. So fascinating, but tough.
Yeah. Well, part of the mission certainly must be your dismay that so much of the founding is forgotten. It's not sufficiently part of popular knowledge. And maybe do you see a deterioration in the education in the founding in the schools, in young people not knowing enough about, I mean, is that part of your thinking here?
Well, look, it's complicated. At the college level, we have finally lost this great generation of professors who went back to Douglas Adair, who died very young, but then Edmund Morgan and Bernard Balin, you know, kept it going a long time. And, you know, Joseph Ellis retired a couple years ago. And he told me as he was retiring, you know, when I retire, I'm not going to be replaced by another founders guy. I'm going to be replaced by someone teaching about looms.
That's unfortunate.
Well, you know, and there's...
He was Mount Holyoke.
He was Mount Holyoke, and you know, you can learn a lot from the history of looms. I'm not dismissing that, but you know, you do want to keep a founder's person on your faculty, or you should. On the other hand, there is the Gilder Lehrman Institute, which does the Lord's work in offering programs to high school and middle school teachers, and they specialize in the founding and the Civil War and also the Cold War.
Right.
We mentioned the Hamilton musical.
Right. That you shows know, there's a hunger.
God bless them. Bless them.
Yes. Did they save Hamilton on the $10 bill?
That helped, yes. That helped hugely.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just have to believe that good stories will win because they're good. So you just have to, you know, you just have to put them out there.
Right.
This is the only help they need. They need the help of memory. That's my job. They did their job. They lived their lives. They did what they did. Most of it wonderful. Mm-hmm. God bless them. We're grateful. What they need from me is to just tell those stories.
Right.
All I have to do is introduce them. They can take care of themselves.
Is it Merrill Peterson? His book's called Miracle in Philadelphia. It was miraculous. This group of figures who come together. They're smart. They're judicious. They've read all their ancients, and it's an extraordinary moment, and it must be preserved. And now you're taking the next step, where we'll move on to the current book. Okay, it just came out last month. John Marshall, the man who made the Supreme Court. It's his turn here. It's from Basic Books. And you're going after John Marshall, the man who made the Supreme Court. Doesn't that mean we need to vilify him?
Well, he saw himself as a defender of the Constitution. He thought the Constitution was a supreme and original act of will. of the people of the United States. You know, there'd been the Constitutional Convention. And, you know, that's what we think of when we think of the creation of the Constitution, how the document was written. That was a secret meeting. You know, no one knew what was going on until the very end when they, lo and behold, they present the Constitution. But then that was followed by a year. Constitutional conventions in every state except Rhode Island. Hundreds of Americans, if you add it all up, were delegates to the various ratifying conventions. So Marshall was part of this process because he was at the Virginia ratifying convention as a delegate. Mm-hmm. So he viewed this as the supreme and original act of will of the American people to change their form of government from what it had been to this. Mm-hmm. And so his job as Chief Justice, when cases come before him, is to rule in such a fashion as to defend the Constitution.
That is a presumption that we all have today. The Constitution is the law of the land. It is the document. But one of the things that comes out in the early chapters in the book was that status of the Constitution before Marshall wasn't quite as firm in those first dozen or 15 or 20 years after the ratification. And among other things, the degree of sort of not lawlessness in America in those early years, but again,
there's a lot of violence
and a lot of lawlessness. And it's unclear how a lot of these things that we now take for granted were to be adjudicated.
Well, that's right. Right, we had a constitution, it had been ratified, there it was. You could read it, black and white, not very long, language not obscure. But still, there's a lot, you know, the rubber has to hit the road. And so how exactly do the states fit into the new system? How exactly is it different from the Articles of the Confederation? Are any of their powers curtailed, or to what extent are the powers of states curtailed? I mean, these are all like blank pages, mm-hmm. and they get written on because controversies arise and they become cases at law, and a number of them rise up to the Supreme Court. And Marshall, as the Chief Justice, and also as a genial and cunning Chief Justice, he can herd all the cats of his brother justices. Many of the decisions of the Marshall Court are unanimous, and many of those are written by him, particularly when it's a matter of constitutional moment.
And he wanted unanimity because he didn't want the court to appear like Congress. He didn't want it to appear, if it could avoid being political in the small sense,
that's
partisan.
Right. That's right. He wanted, there'd been some imprudent stuff. One of his early colleagues, Justice Samuel Chase, a good legal mind, but he'd campaigned for John Adams' re-election. You know, well, Marshall didn't want people doing that anymore. You know, we're not going to do that. Before the Marshall Court, decisions were often seriatim. You know, each justice would read his opinion one after another.
Right.
So Marshall wants opinions of the court wherever possible, where he or sometimes some other justice would read the opinion that they had all or most of them signed off on. Now,
and there were cases in which Marshall actually quite clearly compromised a bit.
Right.
Was a little fluid on his own firm convictions,
right,
in order to bring about that sort of more consensus,
yes,
or,
yes,
unanimity.
Yes, and there are even a couple of times where he as much as says so. You know, he sort of lifts the curtain a bit. But so he's wanting to, he wants to create a court, which will be a court, not just a collection of six or seven justices, but that they're all bonded. He also does this personally. He seems like he was a very genial guy. He liked people. People liked him. The great story is that the custom of the court was that after a day of hearing cases, the justices would go back to their boarding house because they're all coming to the Washington, D.C. from elsewhere, wherever they live. And they're going to stay together in a boarding house for the month that they're sitting. And the custom was they could only have wine during these discussions or during their dinner if it was raining outside. So Marshall would ask usually Justice Story, Brother Story, look out the window, tell us what the weather is. And Story might say, well, it's a perfectly clear sunset. And Marshall would say, our jurisdiction is so vast that by the law of chances, it must be raining somewhere. So wine was always served to the Marshall court. Right. It sounds like he was just fun to be around, and he made use of that. He was also always the smartest one in the room. And he had smart colleagues. There were some very smart colleagues he had. Some of the lawyers who appeared before him, people like William Wirt, Daniel Webster, mm-hmm. William Pinckney, they were smart guys, but they all acknowledged when Marshall gets going, there is just something so powerful about the way he reasons.
And before Marshall, the court was really six separate judges.
Right.
And Marshall's idea was part of the socialization process. Didn't they all stay separately before Marshall?
They had. Yes, they had. And then at the end of his tenure, when he begins to lose control of the court, they start staying separately again.
Okay.
And that's one sign of his aging and the political winds shifting. They're no longer in the same boarding house. And he complains about this because they become less efficient. You know, they're not cheek by jowl the whole time, so it takes more time to hash things out. The kind of stunning anecdote about the pre-Marshall status of the court is that when John Adams has lost his re-election and he's in his lame duck period and he's trying to appoint as many Federalists to judicial positions as he can, then the sitting Chief Justice, the third Chief Justice, Oliver Ellsworth, writes Adams informing him that he's going to quit. His health is bad. I'm just going to quit. So Adams sends to the Senate the new nominee, who is the first Chief Justice, John Jay. He had been there from 1789 to 1795. And then he left to be governor of New York. So Adams nominates Jay again. The Senate confirms him. Then he gets a letter from Jay saying, I'm not taking the job. And he says it lacks energy, weight, and dignity. Now, could you imagine John Roberts quitting to become governor of Indiana?
Right.
Inconceivable. If he did, and then some future president said, Governor Roberts, we'd like you to come back to be Chief Justice again. Can you imagine him saying, nah, been there, done that, I didn't like it? Inconceivable. But that was sort of what the court was like.
Well, was there also a suspicion of the court because it seemed like such a centralization of authority?
It hadn't reached that point yet. That becomes a very acute thing when Marshall is Chief Justice, and particularly because there's been this great partisan shift. You know, he is the last significant appointee of the Federalist, of the last administration that the Federalist Party will have. Mm-hmm. You know, Washington was a Federalist, Adams was a Federalist, but now in comes Jefferson, who will be followed by Madison, who will be followed by Monroe. This is like 24 years of Virginia friends and neighbors, and they're in the first Republican Party.
But Marshall's a Virginian?
Yes.
He's related to all of these people by marriage or by blood?
That can make it worse, can it? Yeah, his second cousin once removed is Thomas Jefferson, and they despise each other.
Why did Jefferson hate Marshall?
Well, let me flip it. Why did Marshall hate Jefferson?
I think the
big destructive thing is he thought that Jefferson was a disloyal Secretary of State to George Washington, that with one hand he was carrying out the administration's foreign policies, but with the other hand he was undermining them and attacking them. And to cross George Washington is the unforgivable sin in John Marshall's mind.
He idolized Washington.
Yes. He had served under him in the war. He thought Washington was why we won this thing. He was the rock. And now here is my fellow Virginian, my cousin Thomas Jefferson, stabbing this guy in the back. There's no coming back from that. He also thinks Jefferson is a demagogue, that he talks a great game about letting Congress take the lead, but he's really manipulating it behind the scenes, and he's most interested in his own popularity. Mm-hmm. He also thinks he's a crackpot.
Man's besotted with these French revolutionaries.
Yeah, or his own wacky ideas like, you know, contracts should only run 39 years and then, you know, like a generation. Now, Jefferson, from his point of view, he thinks Marshall is a sophist, that he will take anything and twist it to a predetermined legal conclusion. Jefferson warns Joseph Story before he gets on the court in 1811. He says to Story, "You must never give a direct answer to any question that Marshall poses you. If he asked me if the sun was shining, I would say, 'I don't know, sir. I cannot tell.'" And the reason is, he would take yes or no and turn it into Marbury versus Madison by some chain of reasoning.
Right, right. And Marbury is, you really mark this as the first momentous decision given
by the Marshall Court. It's 1803, and this is the first and only time that the Marshall Court will strike down a portion of a law passed by Congress. And this is the first time this has happened. Now,
and that's one of the things that established the authority, or that solidified the authority
of the court.
You don't establish, right? It's there already, and Marshall is doing it.
For the first time, he's doing it. Yeah. And same with the idea of judicial review. Marshall doesn't make it up. That idea is out there. Hamilton had written about it in the Federalist Papers. Marshall himself had spoken about it at the Virginia Ratifying Convention. It was an idea that, you know, people were familiar with, but for the first time it's actually being done. That decision is also a scolding of the Jefferson administration for you people said we were the bad guys and you were the good guys and you were going to come in and do everything right, but look, you haven't given William Marbury the commission to which he is entitled. Now, we can't give him the redress he seeks because that portion of the law is unconstitutional, but shame on you. Yeah. And Jefferson knew perfectly well what was going on and resented it.
The second, I think it's the second big trial that you, I mean, the big trial story, and it's actually one of the best, I think it's a great sequence in the book. You talked about these great stories about these people. The episode of Aaron Burr and his treason, I have to say, you start reading it in the book, and it's an amazing story. You can't stop reading about this whole thing. This was wild. Mm-hmm. What happened with the Burr trial, and it made it to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. What was that? Just tell us what that was about.
Well, Burr was Jefferson's first vice president, his first running mate. They get off on the wrong foot because the election of 1800. It's a deadlock that goes to the House because we don't have a 12th Amendment yet, which recognizes tickets. So Jefferson and Burr, thanks to party discipline, they have the same number of electoral votes, which means technically they're tied. And Burr doesn't, you know, step aside. He doesn't tell any of his electors, you know, waste your votes so Jefferson will win. Jefferson naturally doesn't like this. So Burr's only in there for one term, and then after that, he goes traveling in the western United States. He goes down the Ohio and the Mississippi, and, you know, he meets everybody. One of his pals is General James Wilkinson, who's the senior general in the American Army stationed in New Orleans, which we have because of the Louisiana Purchase. Well, the president, Jefferson, gets a letter from Wilkinson saying, I've just discovered there's this monstrous plot. Aaron Burr is going to sail down the Mississippi at the head of 7,000 men. He's going to take over New Orleans, and he's going to invade Spanish Texas and Mexico. And I've stopped this, and I'm arresting criminals, but this is what's going on. And Jefferson is sort of primed to believe this because he doesn't like Burr now anyway, and he tells Congress, he informs them of this letter, and he says that Burr's guilt is certain. This is before Burr has even been apprehended. So he gets arrested on the Mississippi River. A grand jury won't bring an indictment.
So was Burr popular in the region?
Oh, yeah. Burr was, if you met Burr, you'd like him. Yeah. You know, he was just a very gentlemanly, smooth, agreeable, genial man. Everybody who met him, almost everybody, you know, likes him. He makes a great first impression, and sometimes a great second impression. But finally, he's apprehended, and because this little armada, it wasn't 7,000 men, it was 60,
60.
So this should suggest there's some problem with Wilkinson's warning here. But they had set off from an island in the Ohio River opposite what's now West Virginia. So this is the Richmond Circuit. So the trial of Aaron Burr, once he's caught, will be in the Richmond Circuit. And the judges there, there's one circuit judge and one Supreme Court justice, who is the Chief Justice John Marshall. So Marshall's presiding in the circuit trial of Aaron Burr for treason. And it's an immense record. I mean, there are lawyers. Burr has like half a dozen lawyers. He's a lawyer himself. Long speeches, arguments over many questions. But the final, the climax is Burr asks for the testimony to be stopped because no act of war upon the United States has yet been proven. And it doesn't look as if there's going to be any proof offered, any further proof offered.
Even talking about, talking about treason treasonous?
No, well, that's a different crime. That's misprision of treason. That's like plotting treason. But Burr was indicted for treason. The government was prosecuting him for treason. And Marshall says, you know, the Constitution says that treason shall consist of giving aid or comfort to the enemy. Now, we have no enemies then. We're not at war with anybody. Or an act of making war upon the United States, an overt act with two witnesses, or a confession in open court. All right, there's no confession. So where's the act? Where are the two witnesses to the act? All they've produced is people who said, oh yeah, there were 60 guys on that island. They had some rifles and they had some bullets. But, you know, Burr said, well, I wanted to settle Arkansas. You know, I bought some land in Arkansas. These are my pals. We're going to settle there. Yeah. That sounds credible. But so there was no, you know, and Marshall said an act of war, it must be an overt act. Many must witness it. And so he stops the testimony. He says, yeah, we can't proceed with a treason trial in the absence of any testimony that an act of war has occurred. Right. So then the jury only like thinks for a day, and Burr is acquitted.
Didn't Wilkinson produce a letter?
Wilkinson had a letter, ostensibly from Burr. We now think it was by one of Burr's co-conspirators, because Burr never wrote letters.
No.
Burr never
don't write
letters.
Anything down.
No.
That's right.
That's right. He would tell his law clerks, things right. written remain.
Yes.
So never write anything down. So, there was this huge trial. Jefferson is furious that Burr is acquitted. And then years later, after everyone's dead, you know, all of them, Marshall, Jefferson, Burr, Wilkinson, people looking around in the archives in Europe discover first that Wilkinson was a paid agent of Spain for 20 years, and that Burr had approached the ambassadors of Britain and Spain for help with a plot to invade Mexico and to pull off the Western United States.
For
himself, for his own benefit.
For himself, for an independent nation.
Yeah, Burristan. You know, he tells Jeremy Bentham.
And England and France, or England and Spain, would have liked this because
they didn't want anything to do with it because this is just.
But they wouldn't see an interest in the weakening of this growing United States.
Sure they would, but they're not going to trust this guy. You know, who is this guy? He wants help, meaning he wants us to do all the work for him. And I think what finally happened with Burr and Wilkinson is each one was expecting the other one to do the lion's share of the work, and Wilkinson was the first one to figure out that the other guy wasn't going to do it. So at the last minute, he becomes a patriot.
Okay.
You know, so that's their story. But none of this appeared in court. And, you know, in court, you have to go by the testimony that is presented.
And when we think about it, what Marshall did in saying, we don't have anything here, let's stop this, that saved the United States a great deal of trouble, maybe embarrassment.
Yeah, suppose they'd hang this guy, which is what Jefferson wanted done.
Jefferson wanted us hang him.
Well, treason, yes, it's a capital crime. You make a martyr of him.
Yeah.
You know, could have been the issue of who hanged Aaron Burr and why might have been like this inflamed issue in the Western United States for years.
Huh. Huh.
But so it just, you know, Marshall says, no, we can't go further, and that's the end of that.
A last statement for our listeners to tell their high school-aged children. What is John Marshall in American history?
John Marshall is the man who made the Supreme Court a peer of the other branches of the federal government, of the Congress and of the chief executive. He also, in his decisions, he established the supremacy of the federal judiciary over state courts. He said that the Supreme Court could overrule laws passed by Congress, and he also created a legal framework for the economic system that Alexander Hamilton envisioned by securing contracts and securing corporations from meddlesome laws passed by states.
Very good. Thank you, Rick.
Okay, thank you.